The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's Author Events Office, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Charles Kinney, a senior fellow and the director of technology and development at the Center for Global Development. Charles Kinney has extensively contributed to policy reforms in global health, UN peacekeeping, and international financial corruption, among other urgent issues. A contributing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine and a contributor to Business Week, he is the author of Getting Better, Why Global Development is Succeeding, and How We Can Improve the World Even More, a very great, uplifting, ambitious title, and The Upside of Down, Why the Rise of the Rest is Great for the West, also a title I love. He is here tonight with The Plague Cycle, the unending war between humanity and infectious disease. In it, he reveals the precarious multi-millennial relationship that exists in the tensions between such factors as science, economics, technological progress, public interest, and other factors that pit human beings against nature. Perhaps most interesting is the current status of this relationship, as such factors as globalization, climate change, and population growth show us just how tenuous our position is on this planet. The Plague Cycle is a New Statesman Book of the Year and a main selection of both the History Book Club and the Science Book Club. And I also think it goes without saying that this book could not have come along at a more auspicious time. Here to tell you more about it, Charles, thank you for being here, and the screen is all yours.
Thanks so much. It's absolutely wonderful to be here. I do want to talk tonight about where we are today. But let me start back a couple of years ago when I was already writing the book. I walked into a minute clinic with what I'd self-diagnosed as pneumonia. I described my symptoms, primarily the feeling that a bunch of bricks were resting on my chest. And the doctor took my blood pressure and immediately called me an ambulance to the local hospital. As it turns out, one of the veins supplying my heart was pretty much blocked. Two stents and a bunch of blood thinners later, and drugs for cholesterol and blood pressure, here I am, pretty much as good as new, if suitably chastened regarding my medical expertise. Of course, in an earlier age, perhaps I'd never have got to finish writing The Plague Cycle at all. Stents were only introduced really in the 1970s. All of the drugs I'm on to date to that decade or later. But despite those advances, heart attacks and strokes have become America's greatest killer. Not just here, it's also what kills Americans when they're traveling the world. And that's a sign that for all of the advances we've made against heart disease, they're dwarfed by progress against infectious disease, because for most of history, people didn't live long enough to die from heart attack or stroke. They died earlier from infectious wounds or smallpox or malaria or any other of a number of other killer microbes. That history of humanity's past victories against infection is at the heart of the plague cycle. But tonight, as COVID-19 continues to take lives and destroy livelihoods around the world, I want to talk about today and the future as well, and ask if we're entering a new age of pandemics. I'm going to argue that previous victories against infection have created a world that is ironically more vulnerable to new outbreaks than ever. But at the same time, we've also unprecedented capacity to prevent and respond. How well we use that capacity will determine if COVID-19 is just the first of a new series or the last gasp of the era of mass infectious death. The first age of pandemics followed in the wake of farming and cities and trade. Infections leveraged proximity to survive and evolve, and population density and settlement was vital to the emergence of history's most deadly microbes. at first staying in one place for a long time in order to farm would have been a boost to the traditional afflictions of pre-civilization societies. Mosquitoes, for example, would find more people to feed on and more irrigated and cleared land to live in. And the malaria that used mosquitoes as a vector would spread more rapidly when the chance of the same insect biting in succession an infected victim followed by an uninfected one increased by orders of magnitude. A 5,000-year-old Egyptian papyrus on medicine contains a reference to the pest of the year. That may have been malaria, we think, and mummies from the period show evidence of malarial infection. Over time, and largely within the last few thousand years, a more insidious effect of civilization and domestication of animals emerged, the evolution of new infections. Some diseases of civilization evolved from livestock illnesses. Proximity to a dense population of interbred domesticated animals presented considerable opportunities for infections to jump species. Influenza is shared with pigs and ducks, for example, while diphtheria and rotavirus may have spread from domesticated cattle and sheep. And tuberculosis, we think, may have spread the other way, jumped the other way from humans to cows. Human population density of the kind that can only be accomplished thanks to agriculture really matters to a number of the most harmful single species diseases that emerge thanks to civilization. For example, at some point, measles jumped species from cattle to humans. First symptoms are a cough and sneezing, which is how it spreads. Only later does the characteristic rash develop. Hosts can die from complications related to a swollen brain caused by encephalitis or diarrhea and dehydration, also pneumonia. The first time that a disease like measles arrives, it rips through the entire population, infecting widely and killing off those particularly susceptible because of factors like age and malnutrition or genetic variation. But the survivors become immune, often for life. And if most of the population has been exposed, that creates herd immunity. The number of potential victims has shrunk, and so the chance that a coughed out measles virus reaches a non-immune host drops. If that chance falls far enough so that the average person with measles infects less than one new victim, the epidemic eventually dies out. Newborns don't inherit measles immunity, however. As a new generation of potential host grows, herd immunity falls and measles returns to ravage the population of previously unexposed children. A measles victim is likely to pass on the infection to 12 or more people in unexposed populations. And that means for herd immunity to defeat a measles outbreak, more than 92% of the community needs to be individually immune. In turn, that suggests only a few years of new births is required before the proportion of immune kids drops below the share necessary to preserve herd immunity, and measles can strike again. But it has to stay in a connected population somewhere. And the estimate is that to survive and reinfect later generations, measles needs at least 500,000 people living in close proximity, otherwise it dies out. Early empires connected by trade were large enough to keep measles going. As early as the Roman Empire, much of Eurasia had merged into a common disease pool, home to a range of endemic diseases of civilization that usually primarily affected children, as well as new pandemic outbreaks that killed the young and the old alike. Around 160 AD, as Rome's ambassadors reached the emperor in Han China, what might have been smallpox reached back to Europe. The disease killed more people, more than one in four people in the empire. And it was a pandemic from the Eurasian steppe that finished off the Roman Empire in the 6th century, an outbreak of Yersinia pestis that we know as the Black Death. Pandemics went on to devastate populations in the Americas and the Pacific and Africa as European conquerors and colonists spread infections worldwide. Look at Columbus. He or those who followed him into the Americas brought old world infections that killed off the great majority of the Native American population and ended the Aztec and Inca empires. And syphilis may well have been a new world disease brought back to Europe by sailors in Columbus's crew. In its initial foray in Europe, it was far more virulent than it has become, causing ulcers and tumors and immense pain and frequently death. As a sign of the increasing integration of a global disease pool, syphilis reached the Middle East by 1499 and China only 10 years after that, and India was hit remarkably quickly in about 1498. That's because 5 years after Columbus reached America, Vasco da Gama became the first European in modern times to round Africa's Cape of Good Hope. And he did it with a syphilitic crew. For the last few thousand years, infection has killed the majority of those born. It was the most powerful force, keeping the global population in the millions rather than billions, limiting the size and sustainability of cities, and killing off traders and explorers, colonizer and colonized alike. Under the circumstances, it was far safer to stick to the disease pool you knew and stay at home. But by the time of the last great die-offs of populations newly exposed to global diseases by European explorers, the world was on the verge of dramatic progress against infection. A sanitation revolution began in Europe and North America in the 19th century. Sewage systems took human waste out of cities. Pipes and filter systems brought clean water in. Housing reforms and the spread of refuse collection and a newfound obsession with cleanliness all reduced the spread of disease. Then the 20th century brought a global medical revolution. The invention of spread of vaccines against things like measles and tetanus and polio and a range of other microbes, antibiotics that killed off bacteria before the bacteria could kill off their victims, and cheap interventions like oral rehydration that fought off the deadly effects of diarrhea. Humanity's greatest single victory against infection involved smallpox. Victims experienced headaches and backache and nausea and chills, as well as terrible dreams. Then large, red, blistering pustules began spreading all over their body. Their eyes scarred to almost complete blindness, and renal failure and pneumonia came behind, all too often followed by death. In 1796, Dr. Edward Jenner found that infected people with the related disease of cowpox would protect them from the far more dangerous smallpox. He created the first vaccination from vacca, the Latin for cow. Soon after, we saw the first global vaccination campaign. In 1803, King Charles IV of Spain shipped 22 orphans across the Atlantic on the sailing ship Maria Pita. Vicente, age 7, and Pascual, age 3, were infected with the cowpox as the ship sailed. And as the cowpox reached its peak, pus was withdrawn from their poxes and injected into two more children in turn. Children were used because they were less likely to have been exposed to smallpox already. And the serial process ensured there'd be a child ripe with a pox available to provide the vaccine to American populations after the crossing. At each stop, more children were drafted to support the effort. The Maria Pita provided vaccines to Venezuela and Mexico. And then having crossed to Acapulco, the vaccination campaign recruited a new set of children to continue the cowpox chain across the Pacific. From Manila, the expedition spread across vaccines across to Macau and Canton before returning home. Taking the Venezuelan vaccine strain across South America, Spanish Army surgeon Josep de Salvani led the campaign across the Andes to Ecuador. Despite suffering from diabetes and malaria and diphtheria and tuberculosis, as well as losing both a hand and an eye, Salvani continued the vaccination campaign down through Buenos Aires to reach Bolivia in 1810. There, he collapsed and died at the age of 36, with the expedition having vaccinated 1.5 million people. Jenner called it a glorious enterprise and predicted vaccination could wipe out the disease worldwide. He was right, if a century and a half in advance, because in 1980, the global smallpox eradication campaign actually did succeed. Hundreds of millions of people died of smallpox in the 20th century. But since then, only one person, a lab technician, has died from the disease, infected from an accidental release of a scientific sample. But that's just one example. A number of cases of guinea worm, a parasite that causes excruciating blisters, vomiting and dizziness, has fallen by more than 99.9% worldwide over the past two decades. As of April 2020, the wild polio virus, which can cripple and kill, has been limited to two countries. And since 2000, 34 countries worldwide have made massive strides towards eliminating malaria, cutting death rates by an average of 87%. Progress against infection has simply transformed global mortality. 200 years ago, almost half of all the people born died before their fifth birthday, mostly from infection. Today, that figure is below 1 in 25. Think of a young child. For me, it's one of my two daughters. For you, it might be a cousin or a niece or a grandchild. And now think of that child retching and then vomiting once and then again. Imagine her becoming weaker, unable to sit up, chest heaving, struggling with breath, finally growing quiet, dropping into coma perhaps and falling towards death. And then think of another child and imagine it all over again. And again, 5 seconds later. Worldwide, that's about the frequency of under five mortality today. And it is a shocking stain on the world's conscience that many of those deaths are easily preventable. But if we had the mortality rates of a few decades ago, it wouldn't be 1 every 5 seconds, it would be 1 every second. We've cut by more than 80% child deaths just in the last few decades. Or look at overall life expectancy. In 1900, the average person born on planet Earth could expect to live to the age of 33. By 2000, that life expectation had doubled. Today, life expectancy worldwide is above 70 years, the 70 and 10 of the Bible. The decline of infectious death has transformed the global economy. Not least, it's made city living in particular considerably safer. In many of the world's poorest cities today, most urban population growth isn't due to migration like it was through most of history, but city residents having children that actually survive longer than their rural cousins. That is a complete reverse from the past and helps to account for the global growth of cities. In 1960, about 1 billion people lived in urban areas worldwide. Today, that's closer to 4 billion, the great majority of the people on the planet. Urbanization has always been key to economic dynamism. Putting producers and consumers close to each other helps both benefit from scale and diversity, a better workforce, cheaper products, and more variety. And urban areas are the centers of technology advance because entrepreneurs and inventors learn from each other. In the US, 96% of new product innovations occur in metropolitan areas. The half of the world's population that lives in towns and cities generates more than 80% of global output. And international travel is far less risky than it used to be until this year. I mentioned that if you see what kills Americans when they go abroad, it's the same thing that kills them at home, like heart attacks. Hardly any die from infection. Our victories against microbes have made the world safer for globalization. And the effects of lower infection go beyond that. If kids are more likely to survive childhood, parents have fewer children and they invest more in those kids' education. That's a big reason why the average woman worldwide, who used to have 6 or more kids, now has closer to 2. That's why we're moving from a world full of young, illiterate people to a world of the old and educated, with knock-on effects from gender equality to reduced violence. 2020 saw a dramatic reversal in our progress against infection, of course, and it has demonstrated the irony of that progress. It has helped create the perfect environment for the emergence of a new disease outbreak, and for that outbreak to have catastrophic global and social economic impact. We saw that the density and connectivity were key to the emergence of new infections in the first age of plagues. Thanks to our victories over older infections, we live on a more densely populated and connected world than ever before. A single crowded New York subway car can hold about 250 people, for example. Through most of history, the great majority of humans will have lived in communities of that size or smaller. And in an age before motorized transport or decent roads, many people barely left their village. With the human population 250 times that of 4,000 years ago, some living in cities that are more than 100 times the size of a larger city back then, diseases are more likely to find new hosts before they burn out. Add to that a burgeoning population of farm animals, original source of some of our most deadly infections, including flu and measles. The number of chickens worldwide has climbed from 4 billion in 1961 to 22 billion today. More than 3/4 of all that chicken is raised in huge factory farms. And those farms often use antibiotics to speed growth. But that also gives microbes a leg up in the struggle to develop resistance to the medicines meant to kill them. over longer distances, the mechanisms of disease spread have sped up as well. In August 1519, a flotilla of Spanish ships under Ferdinand Magellan set out on the first attempt to circle the globe. 3 years later, one of the ships made it back to home port. Compare that to 1976, when a Pan Am 747 carried 96 passengers around the world in 46 hours. Give or take, that's 1/500th of the time that Magellan took for his expedition. When tourists can travel around the world in a day or two, so can their diseases. And more than a billion international trips are taken worldwide in the course of a normal year. A global world of cities supports a considerably higher quality of life for humanity, but the last year has demonstrated that it can also be brought to its knees by emerging infection. And it would be great to think that COVID-19 was a one-off, but since 1970, we've seen the emergence of a host of new infections, including severe acute respiratory syndrome, avian influenza, Nipah virus, Hendra virus, Ebola, Marburg fever, Lassa fever, variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, whitewater arrhovirus, and hantavirus. That's not to mention re-emerging and evolving diseases, including multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, monkeypox, dengue and yellow fever, drug-resistant malaria, and even drug-resistant plague. Evolutionary biologist Catherine Smith and colleagues at Brown University studied more than 12,000 reported disease outbreaks worldwide since 1980 and concluded that both the number of diseases and the number of outbreaks has been increasing over time. Given how rapidly microbes can mutate and then spread, new global pandemics will surely continue to hurl themselves at humanity. Many infectious diseases tend to follow cycles. Flu seasons move back and forth between hemispheres in a regular yearly pattern. Epidemics of diseases like measles and smallpox would strike every few years or decades as the number of new potential victims in a community climbed. The plague of the Black Death spread mass mortality in the 6th century, the 14th century, and the 19th century at times of instability combined with closer global connections. And some epidemiologists argue that we're in the midst of a new stage of an even longer cycle. After the first transition towards greater disease threats sparked by the rise of farming, followed by a second transition towards reduced threat thanks to interventions including sanitation and vaccines and antibiotics, we're now in a third epidemiological transition, back towards greater infectious risk as a result of emerging new diseases spread worldwide by globalization. What to do in response? Well, this year we've seen the immense cost of trying to stay apart, the economic collapse that accompanied COVID-19. Social distancing orders and the closure of mass transit were necessary, but utterly unsustainable over the long term. And we can't simply unravel globalization to stay safe. Columbus's small crew was enough travelers to help spread an infection worldwide. And the record suggests that pandemics in the last few decades have been delayed at most weeks in most countries by travel restrictions. The world as a whole still reacts really poorly to new disease threats. Rather than deal with a risk before it emerges through better sanitation and stronger health systems, or as it happens through better surveillance and screening and isolation and research, we respond late and in panic. And we're abusing our most effective tools against disease, not just misusing antibiotics by feeding them to farm animals in bulk, but also leaving our children unvaccinated, funding research on new bioweapons while underfunding new vaccines, and letting weak medical systems fester in the world's poorest countries. At the same time, the last year has also demonstrated we can develop responses to disease threats in record time, not least from the first detection of COVID-19 to the effective vaccine rollout has taken less than 12 months. Some countries managed to weather 2020 with very few cases thanks to track, trace and isolate regimes alongside social distancing and mask mandates. And that points to how we avoid a new age of pandemics. If we can't and we shouldn't want to go back to a human population that is small, spread and disconnected as it was in the past, the only solution to our infectious challenge is to use the immense innovative power and capabilities of our connected and urbanized world to develop and roll out a more effective response to new disease threats. Not least, that means improving sanitation in cities and on factory farms and using our existing tools from antibiotics to vaccination with the care and urgency they deserve. And when it comes to new outbreaks, it also means a rapid introduction of track and trace regimes, along with quarantine systems that stop spread in countries, including Vietnam and South Korea. It means methods to speed up research and delivery of tests and treatments and vaccines to an even faster pace than the record-breaking efforts against COVID-19. And crucially, it means global cooperation to tackle microbes that have no respect at all for borders. Not least, and for all its faults, we need a stronger and better financed World Health Organization to help tackle the next pandemic. One with the resources to ensure all of its member countries can detect and respond to outbreaks wherever they emerge. And we need to build on global research capacity and cooperation that has become central in the fight to develop responses and deliver them at scale. Take the collaboration on the vaccine developed against Ebola in 2015. US players in the research included the National Microbiology Lab, Yale University, the Army Medical Institute, and the National Institutes of Health, but also playing vital roles with the Institute of Virology in Marburg, Germany, as well as a German vaccine manufacturer, the Canadian Microbiology Lab, and the World Health Organization. And 9 separate countries were involved in the clinical trials to determine if the vaccine worked. We'll look at the COVID vaccine produced by Pfizer, developed by Turkish immigrants working in Germany, produced by an American company run by a Greek CEO. We work faster and more effectively against global pandemics if we work together. A world of billions living in globally connected cities will always be prone to new disease threats. Through sufficient neglect or miscalculation, we could allow communicable diseases to fight back and reclaim their place as death's most popular weapon. History suggests that such a reversal would shape the coming century more than almost any other conceivable event, more than climate change, far closer to limited thermonuclear war. And even if a full threat doesn't materialize, we could allow poor responses to new diseases like COVID-19 to stifle global progress. But the world has also developed the technologies and the approaches to ensure that those threats can be controlled, limiting the human and economic costs. If we work together, we need not see a repeat of the last year. The choice to avoid a new age of pandemics is ours. Thank you, and I'd be delighted to take some questions. And actually, I already see a couple in the chat. So let me answer if I can. Thank you, Deborah, for a question. Deborah asks, at least here in the US, it is commonly said that the great influenza was forgotten. People don't talk about it much afterwards. Different explanations are given, too much pain, too much going on with World War I, etc. Other pandemics don't seem to have been so forgotten, especially the Black Death, which we still talk about today. Are most pandemics forgotten? And what do you think will be the memory or lack thereof of COVID-19? Thanks. That's a great question. So, yeah, I do think the flu, the 1918 flu, was incredibly forgotten, and sadly so. A bunch of papers have come out in the last year with sort of lessons from the pandemic for now, and they came out in the middle of the year, which for an academic paper is awfully fast, but still, you know, it would have been nice to know stuff earlier because they had lessons about social distancing and masking and school closures and so on that we could have benefited from earlier. I think one reason that people remember the Black Death is that it really was, at least in Europe, in a league of its own. A third to a half of the total population dying in major cities, you know, even higher than that. Indeed, you know, some villages almost escaped the Black Death completely. So it was, you know, concentrated in the areas with the most writers, if you will, and was really just unprecedented in the scale of a disaster. You know, that said, we did manage to forget, or at least not talk for a long time, about a similar level of calamity in the Americas after the arrival of Columbus. You know, there 80-90% of the population died. And I think that's because the colonizers around at the time saw this as sort of God's will and didn't particularly care. And similarly in Africa, the spread of disease related to the slave trade, which moved a lot of people around the continent and spread the disease in Africa. So as well as 12 million slaves being taken from the continent, also killed a lot of those he left behind. You know, that wasn't of interest to the imperialists, if you will. So we do sometimes forget the really mass mortality events as well. But I think you're right that it was particularly easy to sort of forget the 1918 flu because it was happening at the end of this terrible world war. And so, didn't seem such big news in comparison, I guess. It's interesting to note that some of the countries that have done best in responding to COVID-19 are the countries that recently suffered the most during the SARS epidemic. They're the ones that actually managed to roll out track and trace systems reasonably fast. It's the South Koreas and the Taiwans of the world. And so, I wish the rest of the world had learned the lesson that they learned from SARS, if you will, and then maybe we too would have done better in terms of COVID-19. I think the only response to this is to institutionalize stuff. It's to make it, not something where we need to have, really fantastic leaders who happen to be up on the history of infectious diseases. We need to have the sort of automatic processes in place to respond. Now, to be fair to the world, we sort of have some of them. The World Health Organization, for all its faults, did fairly rapidly declare this to be an emergency of international concern, and use the international health regulations, the international treaty we have, in order to suggest responses and so on. I think also we learned that the power of a WHO is not as much as it needs to be to respond properly. The WHO declared this emergency and basically countries in Europe and in the United States then waited 5 weeks before they did very much. Those 5 weeks were enough that it was pretty much impossible to respond in the way that a South Korea or a Taiwan did by the time we started to respond, because there'd already been too much spread. So I think we need sort of national institutions to be in place to respond more rapidly. And we need a stronger World Health Organization, stronger international treaty agreements around pandemics. And that will be a vital part of the response going forward. It's tough. I mean, in the US, tell people that we're going to set up a system that means that, for example, your phone information can be taken en masse in order to help a track and trace mechanism. It's the kind of thing that sets off alarm bells, right? I think you really need to have a fairly major crisis before people are willing to do it. I hope that one of the results of COVID-19 is people go, yeah, right, we see the need for this in emergencies. We're going to set up a system that, while preserving privacy and only to be used in emergency, can allow for a decent track and trace system. I guess we'll see. Anyway, I hope that answers your question. Francis, you asked, please explain how yearly influenza spreads and how treatments are devised. I should have said at the outset, and I will say now, I'm an economist, I'm a bit of a historian, I am not an epidemiologist, and I'm certainly not a medical doctor. And so I want to stay away from suggesting that I know a lot about, the specifics of protein spikes and so on. Influenza goes on this sort of yearly cycle, however, and sort of traditional influenza, if you will, different strains tend to be dominant in different years. And the trick is the North, if you will, learns from what's happening in the southern flu season, and puts together a vaccine that tries to respond to the most common strain that's in the south, which usually becomes the most common strain in the north. And the same trick is played in reverse, north to south. But because there are a bunch of different strains, and because sometimes there are new mutations and so on, that's one of the reasons why the flu vaccine, while effective and while everybody should get it, is not 100% effective in most years. Of course, this year we've discovered an old-fashioned way to deal with a disease like an infection like the flu. It turns out if everybody wears masks and they social distance, the flu season becomes almost a non-event. You know, these traditional approaches work, if you will. And so, you know, again, maybe that's a lesson for next time. By golly, I don't want to go to permanently wearing masks. And I certainly don't want to go to permanent social distancing. But thinking a bit more through, you know, people who are sick with the flu, please stay home, and making it possible for them to do that. I think, you know, is one of the things I hope we learn from the last year and a half. Brian, aren't factory farms a liability? And isn't vegetarianism indicated by your thesis? Interesting. It is certainly the case that a bunch of infectious diseases have come to us through domesticated animals. I mean, a bunch have come from non-domesticated animals, including COVID-19. But a bunch have come from domesticated animals. I do think it is extremely irresponsible of the world to be feeding most of its antibiotics. Most antibiotics produced each year are not given to humans, they are given to animals. And most of those antibiotics given to animals are given to slightly speed the growth of chickens and pigs and cows. And I think that's, I mean, because it is a fantastic way to increase antimicrobial resistance, and because antimicrobial resistance is already a really serious issue, you know, we're seeing hundreds of thousands of deaths a year worldwide. I don't understand why we let that happen. Vegetarianism is one answer. You know, clearly that would deal with the problem. But at the least, much more responsible farming techniques. And countries like Denmark have shown you can do this at a fairly low cost. That better sanitation, more vaccination of animals, much reduces the need for antibiotics. You can get rid of using antibiotics for growth altogether, but even the need for antibiotics to treat sick animals, you can much reduce through sanitation, through vaccination. And so, you know, if we are going to keep on eating meat, and I think much of the world, you know, is, at least for the time being, then at least we should be being much more responsible about it. And, you know, perhaps, I mean, especially with the emergence of fake meat, you know, I can completely imagine the parts of the world where meat consumption is rising because people are getting richer. You can imagine them moving on to a much more sustainable path, you know, a bit like we're seeing somewhat, not fast enough, but we're seeing developing countries move on to a more sustainable energy path than the United States or the United Kingdom did, you know, using more solar power, more renewable energy than we did when we industrialized. Perhaps when, you know, as they see industrialization of our agricultural system, we'll also see them using much more sustainable techniques, including vaccination, including less antibiotic use on the farm and sanitation, but also including fake meat. And perhaps, you know, vegetarianism will also spread earlier and faster than it did, has been in the West. Peter, thank you. Are there warnings on your radar of future pandemics and viruses? Also, do you think the long term, this pandemic changes the way we look at global health and prevention? Thank you for that. Again, not an epidemiologist. So epidemiologists are tracking zoonotic diseases and animal diseases that they think, with, you know, not too much change, could spread to humans, not too much genetic change, or, you know, just bad luck, could spread to humans. So I think there is definitely that potential. It would be no surprise, as I mentioned, you know, we've just been seeing a lot of new diseases emerge. So, you know, it'd be a surprise if it suddenly stopped, to be honest. Sadly, also we're seeing, you know, COVID-19 seems to be busy mutating in ways that might keep it around for longer than we might hope. Although so far, most of the vaccines seem to be holding up. Does this change the way we look at global health and prevention? I hope so. I really do. There are a bunch of old technologies that we should be using better and a bunch of new technologies that we should be rolling out faster. So, you know, sort of prevent these things happening in the first place. As I mentioned, you know, sanitation on the farm is something we should be doing better. Sanitation in the city is something we should be doing better. Especially in developing countries, a lot of people do not have access to a decent toilet. and that helps spread disease. They don't have access to easy access to clean water supplies, and that helps spread disease. It's a current mass killer to them today. It is also a great risk for the rest of the world in the future, in that, you know, the more diseases spread around, the more opportunity they have to mutate, the more opportunity they have to spread outside the countries they start. So, you know, it's good for all of us if the world clubs together and makes sure everybody has access to clean water and a decent toilet. It is good for all of us if the way that meat is grown, processed, and handled is improved. So, you know, there's sort of a bunch of old stuff we can do. There's also, you know, a bunch of new stuff. The COVID-19 vaccines are partially based on, you know, new technologies of vaccine creation. We need more of them. We need new antibiotics. So we should be doing more of that. And we need to work together to do this, because as COVID-19 is demonstrating yet again, infections are no respecter of borders. And so, you know, this has to be a global effort. And I hope, you know, in particular, that is one lesson we learn. Before COVID-19, and indeed in the early weeks of COVID-19, many in America were proudly trumpeting the fact that the US came number one in a global ranking of pandemic preparedness. Look how much good that did us. The US does have immense capacity in, you know, in research. It has some of the best hospitals. It does have some of the best isolation facilities. But it turns out that you need a bunch of other stuff for pandemics that the US isn't the best at. And it's going to be true of future pandemics. Some we're going to be able to handle really well, sort of all by ourselves, and we'll be no threat. Others we won't. And the best way for us to deal with those pandemics is to stop them before they spread, or indeed stop them emerging at all. And that's why these other techniques are really important. And they're important not just in the United States, but worldwide. No country, no person is an island when it comes to infection. Pardon me if I mispronounce Ardashir. Thank you. With the strengthening of the anti-vaxxer movement, there are people that are indifferent if they get a communicable disease, basically acting as if a biological grenade and spreading disease. What is ethical and legal responsibilities of societies when it comes to anti-vaxxers? So I struggle with this a little in that I think many anti-vaxxers, just to leave aside COVID for a moment, sort of the anti-vaxxers that have been around for the last few years, largely parents deciding not to vaccinate their children, doing that, they think, in the best interests of their children. I think they're very wrong, but, you know, they are motivated by love, if you will, not by malicious intent. It's still a huge problem. And it's a huge problem, obviously, not just for them, right? My kids are vaccinated. Why should I care? Well, I mean, the reason I should care, even if my kids are vaccinated against the diseases that their kids aren't, is a lot of people are immune compromised and can't get vaccines. And if their kid, you know, if some kids who can get vaccines don't get vaccines, that adds to the risk that herd immunity fails and infections become common in society. And for those people who can't get vaccines, that can be a death sentence. You know, who really can't, for medical reasons, get vaccines, that can be a death sentence. And because of that, I believe that there is a strong public policy rationale for strong state intervention, by which I mean doctors who pander to parents who don't want to get their children vaccinated, I think should be struck off. There are doctors in the United States who are saying, well, you know, I don't think there's any evidence that vaccines are dangerous. And, you know, as far as we know, they're efficacious. But I'm told by parents that, you know, they think there are concerns and there are worries with them. And who am I to argue? So I think the parents are, you know, right not to vaccinate their kids. I think that is medical malpractice. And beyond that, I think that the state has the right to say, if you're going out in public settings, you need to be vaccinated. So if you're going to school, you need to be vaccinated. You know, you cannot put other people at risk by the decisions you take like that. You know, you can't drive drunk because you might kill somebody else. You can't walk around unvaccinated in public areas with lots of people because you're unvaccinated. And so I do think there is a case for coercion, but, you know, I'd like to repeat, I don't think we should demonize many of the anti-vaxxers. I think they are acting in what they see as, you know, sort of the best interests of themselves or their children. But, you know, we as a society have the right to demand certain behavior on their behalf. And in particular, we have the right to make sure, you know, doctors behave responsibly. I'm talking too long with each question. These are fascinating questions, and now there are a bunch of them. Sorry. So thank you. But it's a question from Adisher again. Is it possible that our production of new antibiotics cannot match mutations of organisms, hence new infections with no treatments? Certainly, let me put it this way. In history, we've seen some diseases that were, as it turns out, fairly easy to develop a vaccine for. And the sort of obvious example is the smallpox vaccine, you know, invented by Edward Jenner way before we really understood the germ theory of disease or anything, you know, over 200 years ago. You know, sort of lucky coincidence figured out that people with cowpox didn't get smallpox, and so started giving people cowpox, and sure enough, they didn't get smallpox. Cowpox is a comparatively harmless infection, and I mentioned a little bit about it in the talk. So that was easy. Measles has turned out to be fairly easy, and sort of pretty much the same measles vaccine kept on working year after year after year. Other diseases have turned out to be a little bit harder. So polio, for example, pretty much the reason that polio is still circulating the world is because very, 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 very few people who get one form of the polio vaccine actually develop polio from it. Very, very few, but enough that if you try to wipe it out globally, you know, that makes it pop up again. There is another vaccine, more expensive, but there is another vaccine that doesn't do that. And now we're sort of switching over to using that one in an attempt to really finish the job and wipe out polio worldwide. Other diseases, more complicated again. AIDS, we still don't have a vaccine against, although, you know, there are hopes. Malaria, we don't have a vaccine against, although there is a vaccine in trial. So, you know, depending on the nature of the disease, it's easier or harder to create a vaccine, infectious disease, it's easier or harder to create a vaccine against them. In the case of COVID, you know, it seems to be mutating quite fast. But again, you know, currently it seems that most of the vaccines are effective against most of the variants. And certainly there seems to be confidence amongst the vaccine makers that they can develop, you know, they can sort of keep up, that they can develop new versions of the vaccine to protect against these new mutations. So the sort of the broad picture is positive, but by no means is it certain that next time we'll be as comparatively lucky as we were with COVID-19, that, you know, basically we actually developed the first vaccine within a couple of days of knowing what its genetic structure is. And then sort of the time between that and rollout was all making sure that the vaccine was safe. You know, with AIDS, it's been a lot longer than that. And so if you had the disease with the transmissibility of COVID, but the difficulty of creating a vaccine of AIDS, you know, we'd be in a different place right now. And again, that's why, you know, the best solution in these cases is not to allow the disease to emerge in the first place, or tamp it down really, really fast. Again, that speaks to, this is a global issue and we need a global response. Nirav, how did Europeans deal with smallpox before the vaccine? Did most people get it? Does that mean most people bore those scars? Short answer, yes. Most people did, or at least, no, I think it's fair to say most people did. If you look at the Stuarts, I look at the Stuart, the British royal family of the 1600s in the book, the Stuarts, and pretty much it's a story of all of them dying of smallpox one way or another. I exaggerate, but and that's sort of what wiped out the whole royal line was one case of smallpox after another. Charles I being an exception. He had his head chopped off, but many of them died of smallpox. You know, royalty was no protection. The first change in that was variolation, which actually was probably a Chinese innovation, although we're not 100% sure, which sort of spread through Asia 100 years before, a little bit after the Stuarts died out, spread through Asia. And then a wonderful character who I talk about a bit in the book, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, went to Turkey and saw somebody variolating and spread it to Britain. What variolation is taking a smallpox scab and scratching open somebody's arm and sticking the smallpox scab in their arm, or taking a smallpox scab and leaving it in steam for a bit and then stuffing it up their nose. It is actually, you know, a sort of an early form of pretty much what we do with many modern vaccines, in that it is intentionally weakening the smallpox virus. They didn't know that's what they were doing, but it was what they were doing, weakening the smallpox virus to give the human immune system a better possibility of responding. So when you scratch the arm and stick the smallpox scab in, basically you're putting the virus in the wrong place. Smallpox usually was breathed in, and the, you know, sort of virus was most comfortable to start off in the lungs, thank you very much. And so sticking it in the arm made it sort of weaker, if you will, and gave the body more of a chance to respond. Steaming the scab obviously, you know, killed off or weakened a lot of the viruses, and so had the same effect. And, you know, again, attenuation is what that's called. And it is pretty much the mechanism we use to create a whole bunch of modern vaccinations, just sort of in a different form. Lady Mary brought it back to Europe, and one of her to the UK, and one of her first customers was actually the Queen of England. She too had lost a lot of her family from smallpox. And so actually, you know, British royals started dying at a lot lower rate after Lady Mary came back, because although variolation was not nearly as good as vaccination, I mean, it actually quite often gave people a full bore case of smallpox and killed them. It was a lot better than just waiting around to get a case of smallpox, sort of the normal way, if you will. So did reduce death rates. Jenner discovered, sort of thought about his cowpox solution, because milkmaids were traditionally thought of as being very beautiful in Britain because they didn't have scars, or at least this is one story. They didn't tend to have smallpox scars. Why? Because they all caught cowpox. I don't know 100% if that's true, but it's a lovely story. Moving on. Walter, how were plagues in the ancient world spread so widely when so few people seemed to travel far from the places in which they were born? And prior to the SARS epidemic, are you aware of any viruses that were airborne? Last part, easy. Yes, there are a bunch of previous viruses that were airborne, including smallpox. Sorry, how were plagues in the ancient world spread so widely? So it doesn't take very many people to spread a plague. You just have to be unlucky, if you will. So I mentioned syphilis. I don't know if you count that as a plague, but that you know, only took few of Columbus's ships to get across the Atlantic, and then only took a few of Vasco da Gama's ships to get to India. The timing of the Black Death, though, is interesting, or the timing of the Black Deaths, if you will. So the first, it was at the end of the Roman Empire. Rome and China, you know, there were these ambassadors that made it to China from Rome, and China was definitely aware of the Roman Empire. There wasn't too much direct contact, but there was a lot of indirect contact, you know, thousands of Roman traders in India, for example, and goods traveling back and forth across Asia. Camels, as it turns out, can catch the plague, and you know, they may have been used for a lot of the of carrying goods across the Asian steppe. So, you know, when you had all the camels and the traders, you had enough people to spread diseases across the Eurasian landmass. That trade sort of collapsed after the Roman Empire, but then started up again just before the 14th century as the Mongols create their empire across Eurasia and make it much easier for trade to happen between China and Europe. The interesting thing about the Black Death, the 14th century Yersinia pestis event, is it's arguable if it hit China at all. And that speaks to two things. One, we think that the kind of natural habitat for the rodents that are the source for Yersinia pestis, where it lives when it's not hanging about in humans, we think they live somewhere in the middle of the Eurasian steppe, or at least did live in the middle of the Eurasian steppe, and you know, that's where the source was. Now, the trade between Europe and China, both in Roman times and in the 14th century, was unbalanced. Actually, it's a bit like the trade today. Money went one way, gold and silver went one way, and goods came the other way. Silk and so on came the other way. Gold is not a great thing for rats to hang out in as they're trying to go across the steppe. Rats are a usual part of the cycle that gets you from basically fleas with plague live on rats that also have the plague, and rats tend to carry the plague around the place. The fleas on the rats carry the plague around the place, and then the fleas, when the rats die, they jump off, they infect the humans. So having a bunch of rats around really helps the plague spread, and European cities certainly provided that in the 14th century, but so did caravans coming across. So caravans coming across with possibly plague infected camels, but also a bunch of rats hanging out in the silk and silk bales and so on. Easy to go one way. Rats don't particularly want to lie on a pile of gold going back the other. And so it may be that that was one reason why the plague seemed to go from the middle of Asia to the west, to Europe, and not so much from the middle of Asia to the east, to China. And so trade deficits can be deadly, if you will. So what was the next question? Okay, what are your thoughts about vaccine distribution? Also, how likely are we to see a new pandemic from COVID variants? Again, not an epidemiologist. As I say, from what I hear from experts, but listen to them, not me. It seems that the vaccine makers believe that we can keep up pretty well. But you will notice that at the moment, most of us aren't vaccinated. And more of us are vaccinated here and in Europe than are in the rest of the world. And the only way we'll really defeat COVID is if we defeat it worldwide. And so we need a lot more vaccines. Now, the good news about that is not only do we have more than one vaccine, we have Pfizer, we have Moderna, we have AstraZeneca, we have a bunch and a growing number. So Johnson & Johnson should come online fairly soon. A bunch of different vaccines made by different techniques, which is nice because it sort of means some are more likely to be robust than others against new variants. Licensed, so many of these vaccines are not just being made by one company; they're being made by, Serum Institute of India is busy making a licensed vaccine and so on. So pretty soon we should have a fairly awesome supply of vaccines and actually be able to manage worldwide vaccination. But we need to do it faster. I mean, next time, and there probably will be a next time, we need to do it faster because of the immense costs of the other approaches that we have, especially if we get things wrong. So actually having society work a bit as normal, but having track and trace and quarantine like they do in Taiwan and New Zealand at the moment, not so expensive, not so earth-shattering, life-altering, as what we're experiencing much of the rest of the world. But if you fail at the earliest moment and therefore can't do that, and you're left with the kind of solutions that we're using in the United States and the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe to deal with this, the kind of extended social distancing and working from home and so on, the costs are immense in terms of livelihoods and you know, lost connections and so on. So the more we can reduce the period that we need that kind of thing and have instead, you know, mass rollout of vaccines very fast, the better. Now, there are some parts of this process that are going to be hard, at least in the short term, to reduce too much. As I mentioned, the first sort of vaccine material was created within, you know, days of figuring out what this COVID-19 looked like genetically. Months and months ago. But you do need to test these vaccines are safe, and that takes a certain amount of time. You know, it takes sticking vaccines in people and waiting to see if they stay healthy, you know, weeks afterwards. And, you know, the last thing we'd want is a vaccine that was actually, you know, dangerous for people, because, you know, we've already talked about the anti-vaxxer movement. Imagine they had a vaccine that really was deadly to a lot of people. You know, the chances that people would take it would go down horribly, appropriately. So, you know, we need to make sure these vaccines are really safe. And that just at the moment take some time. Maybe in, you know, a decade or two, we'll have approaches that mean it won't take so long. And there are challenge trials and things we can speed it up a bit, but not so much. So there's always going to be a period between the emergence of a new disease. At least for the time being, there's going to be a gap between the emergence of a new infection and our ability to create a vaccine for it. But in that period, we can be making sure that we have the capacity to manufacture and roll out at scale. Now, we did some of that with COVID-19, but apparently not enough. You know, here we are with all of these vaccine candidates and not nearly enough vaccines. You can manufacture the vaccines before you finish the trials. We did some of that. We didn't do nearly enough. You know, if the trials go wrong, you chuck away the vaccines you manufactured. It's a bit of a loss of money. It may cost you $1 billion, but compared to the trillions we're losing because of, you know, the global economic shutdown, it's, you know, pocket money. So we need to get a lot better at speeding up the scale of our response, both in terms of our track and trace approaches and in terms of our, you know, vaccine rollout approaches. And I hope we'll do both. Mary, do you advise trying to completely stop the selling and eating of wild animals? So, in a way, that would be easy for me to say. I don't eat much meat and I'm rich. In global terms, I must be in the top 2 or 3%. Probably most of the people listening in global terms, I'm sure not in the US, but in global terms, you're in the top 2 or 3%. Just because everybody, because the US is one of the richest countries in the world. I'm not the main market, if you will, for wild animals. I do think, especially in places where you've got a large population of people, you know, these wet markets in towns where they are, wild animals are delivered live, sort of chopped up in front of you and passed on. At least we need a lot more regulation of that. And I hope that that's something that becomes apparent to the places where it happens more. You know, as I say, I'm a bit loath to say just ban it because, you know, I can afford to buy fancy steak if I want to. And so, you know, this is something that would need more thought and possibly compensation of some kind, so that people aren't in the position where, you know, this is a meat they can afford. Now, you know, that said, there are very fancy and expensive restaurants that will serve you zebra. I don't know, maybe we should just ban that. I don't know, but certainly I wouldn't be visiting them. There's something obscene about that, in my personal opinion. So, Sean, given the major differences between smallpox and COVID-19, most notably a vaccine, what can we apply from smallpox outbreaks to our current and future outbreaks for which we don't have vaccines? I'd say one big thing you can take from a smallpox experience is we did wipe it out. It was a global effort. We have all saved an immense number of lives and money as a result. You and I probably, I don't know your exact age, but certainly I'm 50 and I didn't get a smallpox vaccine because there wasn't any need because we'd wiped it out worldwide. you know, that's just an immense saving and a great thing. So I would say that, you know, one thing we definitely learn is the importance of global cooperation and the advantage of getting all the way to wiping out diseases when we can. We can't always. COVID-19, for example, we think came from bats. And if it's sort of circulating in bats, it would be hard to really completely get rid of it. But, you know, maybe we can control it enough that it becomes a non-issue. Mary, is there any past history of vaccines being developed and dispersed only to find the virus mutated and needed a different vaccine? I mean, yeah, you know, sort of flu is sort of a bit like that. And COVID, maybe. There were these results today about the South African version of COVID that we think emerged in South Africa, possibly being one of the new vaccines not being as effective against it. We will see. Beauregard, Charles, you run the world and can impose one restriction to prevent pandemics worldwide. What is that restriction, regardless of any issues of personal rights? Well, I mean, the easy one would be nobody's allowed to see anybody, right? and I guess that's, you know, thereby is the rub. It would be easy to stop pandemics. We could just stop living, or at least, you know, completely stop human interaction. There are always going to be trade-offs. We make them year in and year out. Do we get a flu vaccine or not? Knowing that it will reduce our risk of getting the flu, which will reduce the risk of other people getting the flu, but it's, you know, not 100%, and it's a pain to go and get a vaccine, and you know, sometimes it makes you feel a bit grotty otherwise. And you know, apparently we've decided, embarrassingly, I decided a few years ago not to get I didn't decide not to, I guess. I just didn't get around to getting the flu vaccine. I promise I'll never make that mistake again. You know, we make trade-offs. It's sort of hard, it's hard to say, you know, and certainly to say for everybody, you know, these are the things we must do, every one of us, to prevent pandemics, because in part it depends on your sort of tolerance for risk and so on and so forth. So I don't have an easy answer to that one, I'm sorry. Deborah has made an important correction based on the fact that airborne in medical terminology has a very particular meaning. And apologies. When spit travels through the air from one person to another, which is how most COVID spreads, we think, that's not airborne, sort of in the medical terminology. And I need to be more careful about, sometimes I use that language carelessly. And so thank you, Deborah, for pointing that out. Nirav, what's your opinion of causing the extinction of mosquitoes that carry diseases such as malaria and Zika? Now there is if I could ban one thing, would I ban mosquitoes? I think probably the answer is yes. Yeah, mosquitoes are, at least on some reckoning, you know, the greatest mass killer of all time. Although in their defense, I don't think they enjoy having malaria either. There are these experiments at the moment ongoing about, you know, gene drive technology and so on to basically have mosquitoes breed themselves out of existence. I understand the worries about playing God that way. That said, malaria is a mass killer, and this may be a really effective way of reducing the death rate. And as I understand it, and one other thing, I'm not as an expert in ecology, but as I understand it, it probably wouldn't have a big impact on, you know, food chains and so on and so forth. That you know, mosquitoes, there aren't a bunch of animals out there who, if mosquitoes go away, are going to die off. So I'm definitely in favor of careful experimentation, at least, but except why people feel a bit doubtful about the approach. Given a virus's ability to mutate, is it possible to create a vaccine that could adapt along with the virus? I don't know how to properly describe it, but is there a way to give a vaccine bandwidth or make it broad spectrum? At that point, I say, you're asking the wrong person. it does seem that some vaccines, so some combination of microbes and vaccines mean that the same vaccine works, you know, it has continued working for a long time. Now, I can't tell you in those cases how much that's about a slower mutating microbe or a broader spectrum vaccine. And it may be some combination of the both. But I'm sorry to end, because this is the last question. I'm sorry to end on one where basically my answer is, I don't know. But I hope that the stuff I did know was of some interest. And thanks very much for joining. Okay. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.